Welcome back, everyone. Nice to see you. We are up to part 7 in our series, Modern Jewish History. We are up to the decade in between, or leading up to, I should say, accurately, the Great War of 1914, which, of course, we know as World War I, which lasts for 4 years from 1914 to 1918. World War I was an unmitigated tragedy, not just for the world, in which 8.5 million soldiers die. And that's a number which, unfortunately, it doesn't seem so big because we're used to World War II. We are familiar. We're unfortunately dealing with the fallout of the Second World War, the Holocaust, which dwarfs the tragedy of World War I. But at the time, World War I was literally an unmitigated worldwide tragedy, and especially for the Jews. In fact, I'll actually take this opportunity just to stress something. We've said this many times. Whenever you learn or read about history as a whole in any level, so there are many different lenses that it could be looked through. So World War I is one of those events which was so massive. Historians would look at it very differently than what we're going to be discussing tonight. We're looking at it specifically from the lens, a Jewish lens, as to the events that World War I began leading into the creation, recreation of the modern state of Israel. What we're going to be doing tonight is going backwards a little bit and setting the scene for this great war. What happened in the 10 years prior? It was not a calm before the storm. The 10 years leading into the first Great World War were a very tumultuous time in Jewish history, and we'll be focusing on some of those aspects and some of the things that came out during that particular time. As I was mentioning, had it not been for World War II, we would talk about World War I as the greatest tragedy in the Jewish people since the destruction of the temple. So what we're going to do tonight, I hope to highlight a number of developments in the Jewish world during this time period, so that we'll better understand the forces that were at play leading into the war, which will then, of course, help us understand the forces at play coming out of the war. The main theater that we will be focusing on tonight is Russia. Russia is going to play a major role leading into this particular war, and of course during the war. Tsar Nicholas II reigned from 1894. He took over after the death of his father, Alexander III, and he reigns from 1894 to 1918. 1918, of course, is familiar. That's the end of World War I. Neither Nicholas nor his father will be remembered fondly by the Jews. They were bitterly anti-Semitic and responsible for rivers of Jewish blood on their hands. Under Nicholas II, there were state-organized pogroms, expulsions, denials of everything that we would refer to as basic human rights, quotas in schools and communities, abject poverty. In a word, Jewish life in Russia under Nicholas II was just miserable. One of the things that this leads to, and again, where this is like a superficial, we could spend so much more time on this. One of the things that leads to, or led to, was the radicalization of the Jews. This group is going to be a major player on the Jewish scene beginning in the early 1900s until today. They will still continue to have a major impact. And it's important to understand where it came from and why it came about. This situation of the Jew was so miserable that, as Jews often do, they look to figure out, how do we end this? How do we get out of this? How do we change the trajectory that we're on? And again, in Russia, they had been on 50, 60 years. It was a long time of consistent misery for a very large Jewish population. So the idea came of secularizing, of changing Jewish life, and by doing so, Jewish destiny. And in general, when you revolutionize, it usually means one has to destroy the old in order to rebuild the new. And there are going to be many revolutionary movements in Russia. We're going to touch on just one or two, not even really tonight, but in future weeks, we'll see some of the major revolutionary movements in Russia. They're going to be disproportionately represented, all of the different movements in Russia, by Jews. And that's for the reason the Jews who were suffering so terribly were looking to revolutionize. They were looking to change their lot, something needs to change. Now, some Jews, as we'll see a little in a few moments, looked inward and said, we need to fix the Jew. Some of these Jews, young, idealistic, thought we needed to change society. That's really where the problem is, and that's really where we need to develop. Now, there were two major catastrophes in Russia, both of which led to major immigration to Palestine. The first was the famine of 1891. Famine of 1891 left over 400,000, there's a missing zero on your notes, left over 400,000 dead, and was one of the causes that set off the first Aliyah. There were also pogroms during that period, and the first Aliyah, which we discussed 2 weeks ago, was basically from 1891 to 1901, 1902, that 20-year period. And this great catastrophe in Russia was one of the aspects that set that off. The second, which we'll discuss tonight, began in 1904 with the Russo-Japanese War. And this catastrophe in Russian history will trigger the second Aliyah moment. The Russian-Japanese War of 1984 was, in essence, a failed attempt by Nicholas II to divert attention out of his own problems, as is often the case of leadership internally, politically, all sorts of distractions and things falling apart around you. So you try to find a common enemy that will hopefully unite your country behind you. So at the time, there were railroads being built, things were expanding, Japan was beginning to exert itself as a power, and Russia decides to go to war thinking that this will be easy schmeasy, we'll take care of Japan, and that will raise morale and establish the authority of Tsar Nicholas II, and that's what basically happens in 1904, and as historically speaking, it was a terrible idea and ended terribly for Russia. What it led to instead was a total lack of trust in leadership, that they felt that they had been led out to war in a failed effort. There was a tremendous amount of revolutionary dissent. There were strikes. There were riots. There was a sense of anarchy. And it led in 1905 to the declaration in which Tsar Nicholas II declares his October Manifesto, which was going to be an end to having a czarist dictatorship and a move towards democracy. This is a massive, important shift in 1905 as a result of the unrest from the failed war. Just as a total parenthetical asterisk on this note, just from a Jewish perspective, there was a Jew named Jacob Schiff. Jacob Schiff was a German Jew who had become one of the most powerful bankers and eventually was going to have a major impact on Wall Street. And he was a major player in financing the Japanese war efforts to defeat Russia. One of his major reasons for wanting to finance the Japanese against Russia was to get revenge for the literal decades of anti-Semitism that had run rampant throughout Russia, if you remember, all the way back from the mid-1800s until this point in history. And here he had an opportunity to finance Japan to take down Russia, which they eventually do. As a historical note, that episode greatly exaggerated in Japan the narrative of the Jew as a very powerful financial force, which would play very favorably to the Jews in Shanghai 20, 30 years later when the Jews travel through Japan. This episode of World War I led to a certain approach that the Japanese had towards the Jews. Just a small little historical note, an interesting piece of information. In any case, 1905, Tsar Nicholas II declares this October Manifesto. He's going to move towards democracy, civil rights, creating a parliament. And that had mixed reviews, of course, within the Russian society. The revolutionaries felt what he said wasn't enough. The moderates, known as the cadets, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that in Russian, were grateful. At least it seemed like they were going in the right direction. And then there were monarchists, conservatives, who were outraged at the idea of changing the way of government and moving away from a czarist system and moving into democracy was a disaster, and they were outraged. That idea, as you always find in government, the old guard, created an organization known as the Black Hundreds, which is, of course, a translation from its Russian name, which was basically an organization of thugs and bigots who blamed everyone for the losses, and they particularly fell upon the Jews. It was the Jews which was the reason why Russian lost the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. They were now behind all the revolutionary sentiments, which is what's causing the Tsar to capitulate and change into more of a democratic system. And they went to work on this. Newspapers, articles, propaganda, pogroms, everything, because this group were targeting the Jews as the real problem, as we are unfortunately so familiar with. That unleashes a wave of pogroms in the summer, the late summer and winter of 1905. And from there, over fast forwarding 2 years in time, which is not relevant for us, by 1907, Nicholas II completely reneges on his October Manifesto. He reestablishes autocratic rulership, and all of the opposition either fled or, disappeared from Russian society. Why is this relevant to all of us? Because this led to a mass exodus from Russia. The unrest from the war of 1905, the after effects, his October Manifesto, which then failed, everybody who had been in favor, when all of a sudden the Tsar takes control back, everybody who had been in favor and celebrating democracy, you're on the wrong side of history. There was a mass exodus from Russia during this period, beginning with the war and the years following. We'll get back to this a little bit later tonight. 35,000 Jews are going to make their way to Palestine. Many hundreds of thousands more will spread out throughout the world. Now, what's relevant to us now is what this did is it pushed many of the young idealistic secular Jews even farther to the left. Watching what happened to their country, that the Tsar, who had about to give democratic rights and then taking it back, and I'm sure it was not a completely peaceful taking back of control, these Jews, secular, idealistic, young, were convinced that Russia needed it to change, that there needed to be a major change in the whole system, not just the Jew, meaning, as I put here in the notes, years before we had started, this was our first class in the series, we'd spoken about the Musar movement, founded by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, which was followed by the Chafetz Chaim, who said the Jew need, when there are problems in the world, especially in the Jewish world, the Jew needs to improve. The Jew needs to change. There needs to be a look inward. These idealistic Jews said the anti-Semitism, it's not a Jewish problem. It's a Russian problem. It's a world problem. It's the whole world is set up in a system that needs to be broken down and recreated. And therefore, these Jews, sensing all of these problems in Russia, they represent and they become very strongly involved in all of the radical socialist, communist, and anarchist parties, which are going to spring up. The Russian Revolution is only right towards the end of World War I, of course, 1917. We'll get to that soon. But a revolution doesn't spring up overnight. All of the groups that are beginning to form, which will become the backbone of the Russian Revolution, many of these Jews are joining, and this becomes the thing to do, the movement that's attracting all of the young, idealistic, energetic Jews. The more that they join those movements, the more that the Tsarist government becomes more anti-Semitic, because all of these movements are the opposition to Tsarist Russia, and the more the Jews join them, and the more that the Jews push those agendas forward, the more the Jew becomes public enemy number one of the government. And this is going to have important consequences, not just to the Jewish position in Russia, it's going to have very important consequences to the entire Zionist movement. This idea of a revolutionary socialist, what's going to become, of course, Marxist, communist movement, which is what the Jews are joining in response to Tsar Nicholas II, is going to have a major influence on the development of the Zionist movement. Putting that thought aside, because we're going to get back to it in a moment, in 1911, there was a very formal suggestion made by a council of noblemen, who were egged on, of course, by the Black Hundreds. They make a suggestion to the Tsar that it's time for Russia to become purified by expelling all of the Jews. And in order to push forward this request in 1911 that the Jews need to be expelled from Russia, the old blood libel is revived. And that is the well-known case of Menachem Mendel Bayless, who is accused of murdering a 12-year-old Ukrainian boy whose body was eventually found mutilated about a week after he disappeared, and the body was found near a factory in which Menachem Mendel Bayless worked. And he was accused by one of his non-Jewish employees as having been the kidnapper and the murderer. And this created a sensational trial that lasted 2 years and took not just Russia, but the entire world by storm. You could look it up. It's a fascinating story. Eventually, he was found not guilty. There was a total lack of evidence. In irony that only a Jew can appreciate, Menachem Mendel had been born into a religious family. And at some point, he left... He left the fold of religious observance, and one of his alibis that saved his life is that he worked on Shabbos, and that served to be an alibi because during the time that this young boy went missing, he was able to prove that he had signed packages that had come into the factory at the same time that he went missing. So in this great Jewish irony, his working on Shabbos actually ended up being one of the things that saved his life. Just as a small detail, the case was just fascinating because the entire thing was trumped up. It was made up. There was zero evidence against him. One of the chief prosecutors brought a witness, a Russian priest who claimed that he was an expert in Talmudic law and Jewish history and Jewish liturgy, and that he was going to prove that Jews indeed needed the blood of non-Jewish children for their matzah, whatever else they did with it, and they put him on trial, on the stand, to accuse the Jews of this. And it became very clear that this guy was a complete Am Haaretz. He didn't know anything about Talmud, he didn't know anything about Judaism, and was literally making up stories. So one of the Jewish lawyers, this is written up in Wikipedia, you can look it up, it's a fascinating story, put him on the stand and said to him, in part of his questioning, can you please explain to us who Mrs. Bava Basra is? Bava Basra is the name of one of the tractates of the Talmud. And so they said to him, can you explain who was Mrs. Bava Basra? What did she do for a living? And so this priest, not really sure what to answer, made up some answer about who this woman was and what she did, at which point the courtroom was filled with Jews, because this was a major Jewish trial, who break out in uproarious, hilarious laughter that this guy doesn't... Bava Basra is one of the most well-known tractates in Talmud, and he's thinking it's a woman and made up a profession. It's equivalent to asking an American who lived at the Gettysburg Address. So the laughter in the court was such an uproar that the reporters who wrote about it said he was discredited on the spot as a laughing stock who knew nothing. In any case, what's really relevant, none of it is relevant because they acquitted him. They didn't have any evidence against him. But over the 2 years that the case draws itself out, the damage is done as we understand. The blood libel was part of Russian society already before and certainly after. And this leads to a massive, as I said earlier, massive exodus of Russians from Russia and a radicalization of the secular, liberal, young, idealistic, became revolutionary in their opposition to the Tsarist government. This is going to give rise to three movements which are going to shape and define Jewish life over the next 100 years. The first is what we've been discussing, is the radical left, as we'll refer to it as, which is a violent minority of idealistic, secular, often self-hating Jews who believed there was no necessity for a Jewish people. They weren't needed anymore. The new Russia that was going to be created, the new Poland, the new Germany, this brave new world was going to have no problems, it was going to have no inequity, it was going to have no social ills, and it was certainly not going to have any need for Jews and their unique way of life, their unique history, their unique destiny. That was not part of this new, what we'll eventually call, of course, communist Marxist ideas. There's no place for the Jew in that. And the Jew becomes, many of these Jews, become a very vocal, leading proponent of this idea. And it takes many different forms. The Jewish Bund in Poland, the communists in Russia, the workmen's circle in the U.S., universalists, labor Zionists, all of them fit under this large umbrella of the Jewish left and these ideas. They not only struck fear into their Jewish brethren about this movement of Jews saying the Jewish people don't have a need anymore, we're going to become universalists, we'll all be the same, we'll all be equal, but they created a great deal of fear in their non-Jewish brethren as well. And they became stereotyped. The Jew became stereotyped as a violent revolutionary radical. That was a classic stereotype that gives, that's born, birthed during this time of, if you wanted to know who's that radical, because again, remember, the Russians are under the Tsar. It's these radicals who are trying to overthrow the government, these new ideas, is the Jew is behind it. In many cases, it was very true, but it certainly became the stereotype. This stereotype then competed with the opposite stereotype that the Jew was the capitalist, money-grubbing opportunist, and literally two very opposite approaches. Was he the capitalist who was running after opportunities to swindle a dollar, or was he the revolutionary looking for a new world with Marxist and communist approaches and socialism? Opposites, and the Jew takes on both, which is a classic we're unfortunately familiar with. This, we get yelled at for being capitalists, we get yelled at for being communists, we're for the Democrats, for the, you name it, we could be yelled at for everything. Even in today's day, today's news, those of you who are following what's going on in Wall Street, just a small snippet of the Jewish role in this story. It's better not to be on these online forums, but I have read reports about them that it is not pretty right now. For those following, just one, what's going on with GameStop and the Wall Street, a number of small companies, their stocks have been promoted. Big companies, big hedge funds bet on these companies failing. It's what's known as a short sell. And the little guys, so to speak, the small individual investors have been, with the power of social media, have gathered together and have basically fought back. And over the last couple of days, you could look into this if you're more interested in it, the big hedge funds have lost billions of dollars. And these smaller guys are making a lot of money off of it. And it is creating quite a tumult in Wall Street. Whether or not it'll be a small little blip or it will have massive ramifications long term and how things are run, nobody knows. Certainly a number of individuals have made quite a profit or lost quite an amount of money. Why is this relevant to us? Because the Jew is involved in every aspect. Two of the biggest hedge fund chiefs that have lost billions of dollars. One is Steve Cohen, a Jew who recently purchased the New York Mets. And the chief hedge fund advisor who's running many of the funds is a Jew by the name of Gabe Plotkin. They're the two Jews who have been not just accused, but have been basically making a buck off of predicting which companies are going to go bad, are going to go under, and that everybody, these small guys, are fighting against. The chief largest shareholder in GameStop is a Jew by the name of Ryan Cohen. He has personally made over $3 billion in the last 2 weeks because of the volatility. So those who are upset at the big guys, it's run by Jews. Those who are upset that the little guys are making all the money, that's the Jew. A Jew by the name of Dave Portnoy, who's the founder of Barstool Sports, is the biggest advocate and one of the people gathering all of these people together. So they're just Jews involved everywhere. So for those who believe that Jews run the world, there was plenty of fodder on every side of the equation. That's what happened in the early 1900s as well. The communists were the Jews, the capitalists were the Jews, and if you didn't like the Jews, no matter what you believed and what side you were on, you had whom to be angry at. That's one of the major movements that develops during this time period, what we'll call the radical left, in the minority, but loud minority of idealistic, secular Jews looking to create a new world. The second group, literally on the polar opposite end of the spectrum, is the Agudas Yisrael. During this time, the traditional Orthodox, what we'll call observant religious Jews, are attempting to organize themselves to combat all of these challenges that are happening from many different angles. We have, of course, the radical left we were just describing. Zionism has already taken hold beginning in 1897, and you have secularism, which has been around since the 1800s, and the religious Jewish community is suffering on all angles, and they don't have a similar movement. The World Zionist Congress of 1897 created this idea of you can organize such a Congress and get people who believe in your, under your banner, under your flag, to come together from all over the world. And look what happened. They did it 97, 98, 1900, 1901. It became something. So the traditional Jews got their act together in 1912 and they formed the Agudas Yisrael, which was going to be comprised of all the major groupings of traditional observant Jewry, with the goal of to preserve Torah values and Torah life. And it was a very large umbrella that included such members, huge leaders like Rav Hirsch's community from the German Jewry community. Rav Hirsch himself has already passed away by 1912, but his community, Hasidic masters from Poland, Lithuanian yeshivas, the Hungarian Jews, including the Yishuv HaYashan in Yerushalayim. We've been discussing the development of Palestine. Palestine has an old Jewish community as well in Yerushalayim, a very traditional Jewish community. This group is led by Rav Chaim Ozer Grodensky, who is the Gadol Hador, the Ger Rebbe, Rav Avraham Mordechai Alter, known as the Sfas Emes, the Chafetz Chaim, who was already an elderly man at the time. The Chafetz Chaim dies in his 90s, in 1933. So this group of Aguda forms, very different groups, different ideals and different visions of life, but they are all unified of traditional Torah values and Torah observance. They agree, they formally agree, that it is not going to become, there's no plan to make it into a unified sect that everybody does the same thing. Like the Hasidim are going to stay the Hasidim, the Misnagdim can stay the Misnagdim, every Rav Hirsch's Jews can stay in their Jewish, in their German approach. There was no attempt to do that. It was just to be under the banner of Torah Judaism, to be able to organize and confront all of the various challenges the Jewish world was facing from the different sides. Not everyone agreed to this, and there were various aspects of opposition to the formation of the Aguda from within the Torah observant world. Two major opponents. One was the Mizrahi. The Mizrahi was the religious Zionist movement, which had been founded only 3 years prior, as we mentioned before, Rabbi Yaakov Reines. He saw the Zionist movement, and just as a quick review of what we had spoken about, and he saw that it was devoid of its religious fulfillment. They were doing something which could be so, not even if it was messianic, but just so Jewish and religious, but it was void of that. So he wanted to create a niche within the Zionist movement of religious Zionism. That was going to bring a religious flavor to the Zionist movement. This Mizrahi movement, which is now at least 3 years old at the time of the founding of Aguda, couldn't join in Aguda, even though it would have been a natural fit. This was a Torah umbrella organization, but the Aguda movement took a very strong anti-Zionist ideology, because the Zionist movement, again, is not religious. The Zionist movement was anti-religious. It was a secular movement, and so the Aguda said, we can't support a secular movement that's anti-religious, as it's founding they weren't even founding the state. The state was going to be 30 years away, but that was moving Jews back. And so Mizrahi, who founded itself on, we need to partner and work within the Zionist movement, that point became an issue that they simply couldn't come to terms with. And this issue, this rift, will run deep and it will run long for 100 years and counting as to how to relate to the state of Israel, which is not a religious state, but it is our state. The Mizrahi movement has said, join, let's make it what we can, let's improve, let's increase, let's do whatever we can. And the Aguda, which has said, it's just not a religious state. And they've had, now their status has certainly shifted in the last 20 years from what it was in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. But this rift has been deep and long-standing within the Torah observant world. Mizrahi simply couldn't find a place for themselves in the Aguda. There were other movements within the Torah world that couldn't find a place for the Aguda, and that was from the right side. And that was those Jews who were strong in their feeling that it's wrong to have an organization. We are unified simply by the Torah and Torah observance. What does it mean to have an organization? It didn't make any sense, and it was wrong, and it was more of a right-wing fringe of the Torah world that said simply not to. They eventually form what becomes known as the Turikarta, which has a lot of specifically anti-Zionist movements and sentiments. But the Aguda, everybody likes to find themselves in the middle. So the Aguda was also in the middle. They were in the middle of Mizrahi on the left, and these more right-wing Hasidish groups on the right. And they would be pulled. A person can always define themselves by what are the two forces that are, pulling at you. What are you competing against? That really will define where a person or an organization is on the religious spectrum. Always, who is it to your right that you're concerned with, and who is it to your left that you're concerned with? That will help you figure out where it is. You know, what's pulling? So Mizrahi was pulling on their left, and these other right-wing groups on the right, but the Aguda becomes a force to be reckon with. Its first Knessia, its first major congress, historically, just an interesting note, was actually canceled. They scheduled it to meet in 1914. Unlike Herzl, who founded his organization with the first World Zionist Congress, the Aguda formed on its own, and then they, 2 years later, called for their first Congress, but it was during 1914, and that didn't happen because of the First World War, but they do meet for the first time in 1923, and that movement, that group, that organization of Agudas Yisrael continues until today as a very powerful arm within the Torah Jewish world. They probably make the biggest noise every 7 years when we have the Siyum HaShas, and literally hundreds of thousands of Jews around the world are part of that. But the Aguda has a very, very strong political arm. Certainly in the United States, they do a tremendous amount of work, and they are very active in many things. And that began in 1912 as a response to the Torah world saying, we have Mizrahi is formed, the Zionist movement is formed, the left is formed, we need to get together and form our organization, and that happens as well during this time. The third major group that forms during this time is the Reform Movement, and this is in the USA. It actually happens a little bit earlier, to be historically accurate. In 1875, Isaac Meir Wise establishes his Hebrew Union College, and in 1885, 13 years later, the famous Pittsburgh Platform officially breaks with Jewish tradition as it was known until that time. I just brought a few of the things here. There's one that I really wanted to focus on. They recognize that in the Torah law, it was a system of training the Jewish people for its mission during national life in Palestine. But today, we accept as binding only its moral laws. Ritual laws like tzitzis, kosher, Shabbos, tefillin, all of those ritual things are irrelevant. They maintain only such ceremonies as elevate and sanctify our lives, reject all such that are not adapted to the views and habits of modern civilization. Shaking a palm branch just doesn't adapt to modern civilization. Putting tefillin on your arms and on your head isn't really relevant. So all a ritual they took away, morality, being honest and not cheating, all of that they kept. They hold all such Mosaic and rabbinic laws that regulate diet, priestly purity, dress, were originated in ages and under the influence of ideas entirely foreign to our present mental and spiritual state. They failed to impress the modern Jew with a spirit of holiness, and therefore their observance obstructs rather than furthers modern spiritual elevation. And they reject belief in the return, the resurrection of the dead, which is a fundamental tenet of Judaism, Gehenim and Gan Eden as places of reward and punishment. And all of this is just to set up the point that's relevant for our discussion tonight, which is we consider ourselves no longer a nation, but a religious community, and therefore expect neither a return to Palestine, nor a sacrificial worship under the sons of Aaron, nor the restoration of any laws concerning a Jewish state. This is what's of relevance to us, that while what's taking place in Europe of the radical left and the Mizrahi and Zionism and the Aguda in the States, which is going to become a massive home to a large number of Jews, the largest and most powerful of those movements is going to be the Reform Movement. The Reform Movement officially adopted a policy: we don't believe in a return to Palestine. This whole Zionist movement taking place is not part of our world, our yearning. They removed all references to Jerusalem and Zionism out of their prayer books. And nor they had any restoration of the laws concerning a Jewish state. It wasn't part of their world. So as the Jews begin to return to Palestine, so not only are we going to have many different factors of Jews as to how to relate to that, this very powerful reform movement in the States was theologically opposed to the idea of a return to Jerusalem, to Zion. We are a religious community, but no longer a nation. The melting pot idea, which of course was famous in the U.S. in the early 1900s, was a very fertile ground for Jews. It was, as a religious Jew speaking, it was a disaster for the Jews who came to the States in the early 1900s, because the melting pot and the reform movement just simply allowed them to do away with their religious practice. And by the time the Orthodox Jews make it 50 years later, when they come in mass to the U.S., Reform is already the established practice of Judaism. That's what it means to be a Jew. That's what was there. And the Orthodox, who were coming now, broken, survivors, immigrants, no money, no language, they just didn't find a welcoming home to religious practice. That just wasn't the culture of the states. Conservative Judaism, which also begins in the late 1886, the Jewish Theological Seminary of America is founded, who also believed that Judaism was a human but not a divine institution developed in response to the needs of the world throughout the ages. This is what the Orthodox world steps into. What's relevant to us again is, as we move towards the First World War and then the Holocaust and then the founding of the state, the majority of Jews, overwhelming majority, it's estimated 90% of Jews in the U.S. and Canada at this point in time are affiliated with a reform conservative movement that had no interest theologically and certainly not in practice in going to the land of Palestine, not to support it. It just wasn't on their radar screen. So that gives us three things that are taking place simultaneously, basically, in the world. In Russia, we have a mass exodus of Jews from Russia and the forming of a radical left Marxist communist socialist ideology. We have the Aguda forming of the Torah world getting together in 1912 and forming its organization. We have the continuous development of Zionism, which we spoke about last week. And of course, within that, the Mizrahi movement. All of this is what's laying the groundwork. This leads us to our final point for tonight, and that is the second Aliyah. We had one class on the first wave of Aliyah. Historians basically divide up the movement of Jews back to Palestine into a number of different waves. So the first one was, as we mentioned earlier, from about 1891 to about 1901, 1903, in that 20-year period. That came mostly from Russia, a little bit from Yemen as well. And now we have the second wave, which begins with the pogroms and the war of 1904, as we mentioned earlier, and that will continue until the First World War of 1914. During this 10-year period, about 35,000 Jews immigrate to Palestine, mostly from Russia. Again, going over the numbers that we discussed of the numbers of Jews who are living in Palestine at the time, 35,000 in a 10-year period is a massive influx of Jews. These Jews are mostly fleeing oppressive persecution of Russia, like we mentioned earlier, as well as a tremendous economic hardship. But this is only a small percentage of the Russians that are leaving. The vast majority of them go to America and elsewhere where economic opportunity was far greater. What would drive this group of Jews to go to Palestine, which was economically depressed? Why are they going there? And this is what's of great significance historically as a whole. Unlike the first Aliyah, the first Aliyah had a number of different ways. Remember, it was very much supported by the Chovevei Tzion. Chovevei Tzion had many religious voices. It had a lot of secular voices. It was probably mostly secular, but it had a strong Jewish identity, a Jewish culture. They wanted to recreate a secular Jewish culture, but it was a Jewish culture that was mixed with these flavors. It had threads of messianism and traditional Jewish thought. All of that was included. This second wave, what would drive these Jews from Russia to go to Palestine, where economic opportunities were not like they were in the U.S.? What was driving them was this secular, idealistic, zealous belief of building a Marxist, new communist world in a new land. This was the revolutionary, radicalized, leftist Jew who didn't just want to repair Judaism. They were on a mission to repair the world. And Palestine offered this unbelievable once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to run an experiment and create a new world. You could actually do it. And this group, who believed in the rights of the proletariat, the triumph of the international workers' movements, they were convinced of the irrelevance of Jewish history. That was not part of their goals. And it was a very purposeful break with Jewish tradition and religious faith. With the theme of Jewish labor, the sanctity of labor, whose enemy was the excesses of capitalism. This is different than the first Aliyah, which was, again, mostly secular, but with a strong Jewish culture. This is about creating a new Jew as part of a new world. In practice, what it looked like was the kibbutz. the kibbutz, in which you all contribute according to your ability, and everyone receives according to your needs. And nowhere in the world could this experiment be run as successfully as in Palestine. And with their sweat and their blood, they drain the swamps, they clear the land. First, Aliyah employed Arabs. You remember we spoke about this. It created a lot of problems where they would hire the Arabs to work the land because it was cheap labor. It was better than the Arabs were getting from their own Arab absentee landowners. And so the Arabs began to move in because economic opportunity was great. In the second Aliyah movement, never would they hire, never is a strong word, they would not hire Arab workers. Ben-Gurion himself declared, there's a quote from his own book, "Let Israel know clearly that Jewish landlords will never restore the land to Israel unless there be Jewish workers." This was a socialist ideal, it was a socialist experiment, and we were going to work the land with Jewish hands and Jewish sweat and Jewish blood, not to hire the Arabs. It was very anti-religious, not just secular, not just Haskalah, the Haskalah movement, the Enlightened movement we spoke about in Eastern Europe during the late 1800s. They were such a Yiddish-speaking, Jewish, culturally sensitive group. The group that came to Israel now was determined to stamp out Jew. It wasn't part of that socialist equation. There was no Shabbos, there was no Yom Kippur, there was no Kashrus. It wasn't part of their world at all. Hebrews, this is where it was, we spoke about the end of last week, Eliezer ben Yehuda and the rebirth of the Hebrew language. Hebrew officially becomes their new language. There's going to be a new Jew who's going to be a worker. He's going to be idealistic, selfless, indifferent to wealth and religion, concerned with society and not the individual. And this is a very different flavor than the culturally secular Jew, like we mentioned before, socialist, radical left-driven movement. And this would, of course, impact Zionism for years, because at the end of the day, this group had a tremendous, tremendous role in developing the land. They did. And so the flavor, the socialist flavor, was going to have, of course, as we're familiar, a very, very long-lasting impact still today on the state of Israel. And when we will talk more about the religious and secular divide in the land of Israel, which I don't need to tell you is still unfortunately alive and well in the land of Israel today, but when it begins in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, in that era, the seculars in control of the land were virulently anti-religious. It was to create a new Jew. Part of the army's agenda was to reprogram, recreate a new culture. So when the religious community didn't want to send their kids to the army, it was for very good reason. Things changed over the last 70 years. But in the beginning, that's what was taking place. And what this does, first of all, just a parenthetical comment I have here in the notes. Many of these Russian Jews who do go to the States, only again a small percentage go to the land of Palestine. Those who go to the U.S. also have a very strong, socialist flavor into the U.S. reform movement and reform thought as well, as they also come to the States and with their socialist passion. What it does in the land of Palestine, which is our main agenda, is it creates a much wider gap between the religious community that's already there and these Jews of the second Aliyah. You couldn't be farther apart than the traditional Jew living in Yerushalayim for many centuries, who wanted nothing to do with the secular world, and the secular Jew that's now arriving. There was a tremendous amount of tension and a very wide gap between the Jew that was already living in the land and the Jew that's now arriving from Russia with his revolutionary socialist ideas. It also created a very easy target for the Aguda and their anti-Zionist approach. Mizrahi is trying to bridge that gap, and that gap becomes much more difficult to bridge when the Aguda says, how can we support this endeavor that's going on in the land of Palestine? Look at what they're doing to our religion. Look at what they're doing to Shabbos and to Yom Kippur, and they're in the land of Israel. How can they do that there? So that becomes a very easy stance for the Aguda to take, which they're able to take that stance for decades, correctly so, saying it's a threat to the existence of Torah Judaism, which makes a wider gap between Aguda and Mizrahi, who's trying to work with the early Chalutzim and the Jews who are coming to settle. And all of that is brought about in this second Aliyah. There is a journey of repentance, a famous trip that Rav Kook, who becomes Palestine's first chief rabbi, pre-state Israel, together with Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who was the leader of Yerushalayim, the Haredi Jews in Yerushalayim. They took a trip together in 1913. We spoke about this once a couple years ago on our lecture on Rav Kook. And they went around to various dozens of kibbutz, kibbutzes to try to inspire them and to bring kosher, to bring Shabbos, to build shuls. They went around. And they had many mixed results. Some kibbutzniks threw them out. They wanted nothing to hear from them. Some listened politely and then sent them home. And some actually made changes. They created some kosher kitchens and built some shuls. Like any endeavor, it was a mixed bag of results. But and each one, Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld, took from the trip a different approach. Rav Kook saw in this the great potential that the secular Jews had to be able to be brought back to the fold, and dedicates the rest of his life to engaging the secular Jews that are in Israel. The Rav Zonnenfeld saw in this a hopelessness. He came into contact with these kibbutzniks, which were so far from Judaism, Torah Judaism. No Shabbos, no Kashrus, no, they didn't know anything about it. They didn't want anything with it. And he left disheartened and said, there's no hope for these Jews. The only way that we can protect Torah observance is to distance ourselves from them. And this furthered that gap as well, which will also define the next 20 years of the Jewish state of Palestine. Rav Kook leading Mizrahi, trying to engage the secular Jews, trying to teach, trying to uplift, and the traditional Jewish world, religious world, saying, this is a threat to us and to our children. We need to insulate ourselves. We want nothing to do with them. If this sounds familiar, it's because this is continuing to play itself out literally until today in the state of Israel and elsewhere around the world, the divide, trying to figure out this issue. But this began in the second wave, and not as it began, it really was brought to the forefront during this second wave of Aliyah, following the unrest in Russia, and the various movements that are taking place and shaping the Jewish world during this decade. Next week, Mirtz Hashem will start the First World War, which, as I said in the very beginning, was a disaster for the Jewish people, and the upheaval that it will create will then recreate the landscape of the Jewish world moving forward as we continue to progress towards the development of the State of Israel, still 30 plus years down the road. Looking forward to continuing our journey together next week, and I thank you all, as always, for joining together.
Thank you, Rabbi.